Well, my name is Billy Viatana. I have met all of you by now that are here. And this is the first session in a series of five on stories and self. And tonight's session is entitled A Flood of Compassion, North Dakota et al. I'm also pleased that Heather Tweet could join me tonight. She lived in Grand Forks last year as a first-year medical student at the University of North Dakota, so she has some first-hand stories to tell. And some of you may have some stories, too, about, and we're saying that there were some evacuees in your area, even though you weren't too aware of them. But maybe about other disasters and that you have been a part of, experienced, or have been responding to. And also stories, these are stories of disaster, but also stories of compassion, of the response to disaster. So I wanted to say a couple of things about stories, but I'll elaborate more on this in our next sessions so we can get on to the stories about the flood. But stories shape us, and we shape our stories, and our lives are a continuous, ongoing story. Sharing our stories and listening to the stories of others, we often find in listening to other people's stories something of our own story, some pieces, like a kind of aha moment or a knowing, a connecting with that person's story because it connects with our story. So tonight, as we listen to some of the stories about the flood and stories about disasters and stories about responses to disasters, maybe you can find some pieces of your own story in this as well. Now, I'm sure that there isn't anybody here that hasn't heard some or a lot about the Red River Valley floods. They started back in April, and they affected the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, who many of whom were evacuated from the different cities, and also then the people that responded in the immediate area and others where that took people in and responded to their needs, as well as it touched the lives and the hearts, I think, of people across this country and even internationally. There was response to the flood victims, and I'm sure there'll be many stories still coming out related to that. There has been an outpouring of response to the flood victims, of many different kinds of gifts, of money, supplies, volunteer labor, emotional support, prayers, just a variety of responses and outpouring, some of which Heather was a part of, some of which I also saw and experienced. So the stories we share tonight are about the survivors, the evacuees. I don't like to call them victims because I think they're survivors, not victims. The evacuees and their heroic efforts before the flood began, along with many volunteers. And then the evacuation and the dislocation of these people and its disruption of their lives in so many different ways. The stresses they experience, the losses, as well as the returning and having to face the reality of those losses. But there are also stories about the resiliency of these people, the courage, the importance of picking up their lives again and rebuilding and going on. I was amazed by them. And then there are stories of compassion, the outpouring from many of the immediate communities around the flood areas. And I was privileged to be a part of some of those smaller communities working with the Red Cross. The churches in those areas, the civic groups, the schools, and then there were corporations nationally that were sending carloads of various things and doing individuals in different communities, sending money and sending supplies. It was an amazing mobilization of help in so many different ways. So we're going to begin with a little framing of this tonight. And first of all, I drew a little map just to get a sense of where this happened. So the place, the Red River forms the line that separates North Dakota and Minnesota. Comes right down. From Breckenridge north, because of the Continental Divide, the river runs north. So that was part of the problem, because it was colder the farther north, and the river, instead of being able to move through very quickly, hit ice at different places. So it spread out into farmland areas here. So some of the farm, up in the Grafton area where I was, that wasn't affected itself. It became a kind of center for outreach to people. Whoops. I better hold it. Grafton wasn't affected, but along the river, on both sides, the North Dakota and the Minnesota side, were these, it was just a sea of water with the farms as islands in that sea. It was an amazing sight. You'd go down a road and it would disappear. There was one of these signs that shows a squiggly road. Well, that sign was just at the point where the road disappeared into the water. So the flood started down here in the Breckenridge area and Wahpeton, and then moved up to Fargo, Moorhead. I don't think Moorhead had as much problem as the Fargo area. And then up to Grand Forks, and that's probably what you heard most about, is the Grand Forks area and East Grand Forks on the Minnesota side, where, well, I'll let Heather take it from here and tell you more about what happened as preceding the flood.
You don't need to take it.
You don't need to take it with you?
No, we hear you. There's me up here hanging around. We can hear you. Just
okay, so I go up there.
I just came out to watch what you were doing.
I thought you were giving me a message here. Okay. So Heather, why don't you tell us more about what it was like for you when during that time?
Okay, I want to start a little bit earlier to give you a little background of this whole winter. Even here at Holden, you heard it was about double the snowfall. It was a terrible winter everywhere for everyone. When I came to medical school, they say we never shut down. I was at school about 4 days, total of snow days. It was a terrible winter. And end of March, early April, it kind of calmed down. The weather was getting better. They said, no, we always get one more snowfall. And somewhere around April 7th, we got that snowfall. And it wasn't so much a snowfall as the worst blizzard we've ever had. I was without power for about 20 hours. No heat. I couldn't cook. I had no food. You know, college people have mac and cheese, and you can't make that without electricity. No phone for a lot of while. But the surrounding communities outside of Grand Forks neighborhoods got their electricity back neighborhood by neighborhood, but the outlying small towns were without electricity for weeks. And so a lot of people were brought to the community center where they had generators. And so, you know, this was a big inconvenience. There were the elderly and the small children all together. And, you know, it was kind of fun. You could play games, but you just want to be in your own home, go to your bathroom and take a shower and just cook your own food. But little did we know, that was nothing. I was complaining about those 20 hours. It was really bored. About mid-April, we started hearing about the Fargo blizzard. I went to school in Moorhead, and some of my friends are still there, so I was talking to them on the phone, and they were out working on the dikes all night. I called about 10 o'clock, and the girls were out the door, and they said they're doing the night vigil. And it was a sense of power and of hope in Fargo. They were beating this thing, and this was containable. And yes, there was some damage, but everyone, the community really pulled together, and they were able to beat it. And meanwhile, we were in Grand Forks, knowing the water was coming our way, and listening to the flood predictions. Early flood predictions were 49 feet, and the dikes protected to 48. So we knew we had some work to do. So the dikes were built up to 49 feet. Next day, 50 feet, and so on and so forth.
Now, were you still in school at this point?
Yes, I'm still in school at this point. April 16th comes along, and I came back to school after morning classes, after lunch, and the president had called off school. And the students were all to go out and help to build the dikes up with the sandbanks. And so we were all like, great. And the teachers had warned us, because in 79, they said that the university had become an island. The flooding was so bad in 79. And they said, you might be out of school a week. So we're like, okay, we kind of expected this. It was kind of fun. We went out to one of my professor's house. He was a great guy who would come in on Saturdays and help us with our lab studies before tests. So when he needed help, they were out there, just it was snap. And it was fun. You know, the water at that point was about this far from the dikes we were building. And we were asking them, where is this river usually? And they said, we can't see the river from our house. And so we just built the dike up, and they ordered about 20 pizzas, and there was hundreds of people around and having a good time. You know, it was, you know, a sense of, we're protecting our neighborhoods, we're gonna do this. And
didn't you say one woman was washing her car?
Oh yeah, as I was driving to the area, the people who weren't by the river, they were like washing their cars and just hanging out, and no one expected it. Mm-hmm. And that first day I went sandbagging, I happened to be in the sandbagging line with the lady who lived in the house next door. We're also decking her house. And she was telling me how it floods every year in Grand Forks. It's just normal, and the deck systems protect against that. And she has this great deck. She likes to sit on her deck in the spring, and the water comes up, and it's beautiful, she says. She loves it. And they measure the flood waters by the playhouse and how far the water comes up on that. And it was about halfway up at that point. So that day was pretty fun. We did a good job. We got the deck built up. The water was fine. Didn't really worry about it. That night we went to a movie.
When was that?
That was April 16th.
16th. Okay, Wednesday the 16th.
Okay, so the 17th, starting to get a little scarier. The radio stations now weren't playing music. It was just, we have 15 people here, we don't have anywhere to work. Someone else would call and send them to this address, and they'd all go there. We need people at Sandbank Central, we need people at this address, and everyone was helping out still. It was a little bit more urgent, getting a little bit more frightening. Some of the homes, by this time, you had to boat out to them. they were running ferries, like their speedboat and fishing boat, and my friends would have to go out there. And that was the dean of our medical school. They were sandbagging his house, and they had to bolt out there. By this time, businesses were shutting down all over town. There was no alcohol. No, we were not allowed to sell or buy alcohol. All the bars were shut down. Everything was shut down. Just the whole thing was concentrating on the flood plate. Some houses were under at this point. There was one house in the area. I was digging that you could just see the roof, and some were starting to come in, but nothing like what it ended up to be. Okay, that was the 17th.
There's still no water in the streets? You were still driving around anywhere you wanted?
We're still driving around, and I think that night dikes started to break and started having problems. It was on the 18th that I was awakened by a phone call from my best friend in medical school. Heather, can you get over here? We're taking everything out of my apartment and throwing it upstairs. Mm-hmm. So that was I got up, put some clothes on, ran to her house, and the whole apartment building was just emptying up to the upper floors. It didn't really matter where things were. You're just putting it on upper floors just to get it out of water reach. And from there, a friend and I grabbed some breakfast and we went back over to the house where I was originally sandbagging. We had to park about a mile away. This day was utter chaos. I've never seen anything like this in my whole life. National Guards people on every corner, helicopters constantly overhead, sandbags everywhere, and hundreds, thousands of people just going around trying to figure out where to go, what to do. So we walked about a mile in, finally caught a ride with someone who had made it through. Sand trucks, they had cement trucks and gravel trucks just constantly going through. We just got out of their way. And we went back to where we had were sandbagging that original day. The lady that I had been in line next to sandbagging, she was telling me how she loved her house. Gone. She couldn't handle it. It was just too much. The water was now about that far from the top of the dikes. It was leaking through, and the pumps were, slowly losing the battle. So we got to that house, and the first thing we did was, the niceties were gone, the flood was gone. The owner of the house, our professor, could barely speak, and when he did, it was almost tears. And he couldn't even function. I mean, he was just trying to do, it was just so much, this is his home, and it was a nice home, and he built this up. And so finally one of the medical students just took over, because there's hundreds of people there, and it was just chaos. And if no one's in charge, it's hard to deal. But someone finally took over. About 10 of us just went into his basement and took everything out and just threw it upstairs. It was a total mess, but at least we got things out of the basement. It was really like a war. I can't even stress that enough. It was just the most, it was really scary feeling. That's when I knew that we were in trouble. I can't explain it. At this point, the radio and TV personnel hadn't slept, and they were just constantly broadcasting. I don't know if any of you saw the broadcast, but they just looked awful. And everyone was just really stressed out. This is when dikes started to break more, and all through that night, the sirens went off, and that meant one more neighborhood was being evacuated. Mm-hmm. And my friends, Dan and Kirsten, they're a married couple, live in one of the neighborhoods and were evacuated, and they didn't sleep all night because they're wondering, is that our siren? Is that us? And
it was like a real war zone. Yeah.
Waiting for bomb sirens or something. Mm-hmm. By the next day, there were six of us in one apartment, two dogs and a cat. And that's after all the dikes had broken and the water was in the streets and the water was shut off in our faucets and there was really nothing left. All the businesses were down. There's nothing left to do.
So is that on Friday, the 18th?
The 18th, the dikes broke and all through the night, everyone was evacuating. I got a call about 2 a.m. One of my friends said, I'm leaving town. She has a three-year-old daughter. She's like, I'm out of here. Do you want to come with? I said, no, I'm fine. It was just kind of a panic thing because no one knew how serious it was and how far was the water going to get and everything. But on the 19th, which is Saturday, there are a bunch of us in an apartment. Bill and Jackie live downtown, which was the worst hit. And so they had been evacuated, and Dan and Kirsten. And we were all at another friend's apartment. And we decided that we should just leave town because there's nothing to stay for anymore. And they had gotten out in the middle of the night. Jackie left a strawberry pie in the fridge because we all expected, you know, we're going to come back. This will be 2 days, we'll be gone. Dan and Kirsten, you know, just have the clothes they had and their dog and their cat, you know, just that's all they say. Really took some of their wedding pictures and things. That's about it. We decided to go out to my house. I live in the center of North Dakota, which is about 4 hours away. And as we were driving out of town, we saw the fire and the airplanes flying overhead. And when we got to Newburgh, Jackie was just literally shaking. I lived on the other side of town, so I wasn't affected at all. But Jackie, who had been through this, was literally shaking, and we were watching the news, and the fire was, you know, a block away from their apartment. So to sit there with my friends, and we saw these aerial views of Grand Forks, and it's hard to pick up things from aerial views, but when it's all underwater, it's near impossible. But we were trying to find our houses, and there was water surrounding their houses, and it was just not a good night. Everyone was real silent, and it was just scary. Sunday found us in church the next morning, and there was another lady who had evacuated to Newburgh as well. So there was seven of us all together in a town 4 hours away, and my town was 100 people. And people in church were asking me if I had more friends that needed a place to stay. And everyone wanted to help, you know, even that far away. They didn't really know anyone, but everyone wanted to help.
That's so you me. Left?
Yeah, I left.
You left, and most of the residents of Grand Forks?
50,000 people.
50,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. I'm going to read part of a column that a journalist who lived 20 years in Grand Forks and is now a columnist or journalist with the Minneapolis Tribune. But he wrote on Monday the 21st, Sunday morning, that's Sunday the 20th. Sunday morning in Grand Forks, my town for 20 years. Robins chirp as the sun rises on what promises to be another beautiful spring day. Saturday was gorgeous. Everybody said so wistfully. I sit on the stoop outside my brother's house, drinking Tom's good coffee and watching Rags, the chocolate lab puppy, bedevil Duke, the 12-year-old black lab. Except for the robins and the dogs and a distant grinding sound, the sound of a heavy truck at work, it's quiet. It's early Sunday morning, after all. But it will be even quieter later today. Tom and his labs will be in Valley City, North Dakota. My other brother, Jerry, will leave soon, may have left already, for a motel in Eden Prairie. My son, Pete, left Saturday. He and Rochelle, his girlfriend, packed up the dog, the cat, and poor Hugo, their psychotic rabbit, and rode by caravan with friends for Sarles, North Dakota, to the west, and a couple of miles from the Canadian border. I don't know where my great-aunt Martha has gone. The last I saw her was Saturday, on the front page of the Grand Forks Herald. She was sitting on a stairway in her home on Olson Drive, crying. She stood up a few minutes later, the newspaper told me, took a couple of pictures off the wall, told firefighters to flood her basement with clean water, and left. Outside, she reached up to a man she didn't know, pulled his head to her until their foreheads touched, and asked, "Do you have any idea how important a home is?" Thousands of homes are gone. Tens of thousands of people have gone. My town is abandoned. It is flooded, burning, and abandoned, except for the people fighting the fire. A fire and a flood? And the National Guard troops who remain to watch over the city. For 20 years, I lived here. I worked here at the Herald, which didn't come Saturday, Sunday, because there's nobody to deliver it, and precious few left to read it. I don't even know if a Grand Forks Herald was printed Sunday. The Herald building is on the block that's burning. Where is Mike, my friend and editor at the Herald? His home in the Riverside neighborhood is flooded. His business is flooded and may be damaged by fire. Somebody said he and Suzette went to Thompson, North Dakota, but I don't know. I can't call him, go to him, tell him I'm sorry. So many people, friends, and I don't know where they are, how they are, how they will be in a week, in a year. I once owned a home on Chestnut Street. It's where my son grew up. It must be flooded. I don't know. I can't see it. Do I want to see it? The university, my university, is closed. Downtown is smoldering. On Saturday, I watched from my brother's yard, 3 miles away on the far west side of town, as airplanes and helicopters dropped chemicals and water on downtown. There was a faint, pretty moon in the afternoon sky, and the planes and the helicopters seemed to swirl around it, and the plume of black smoke that rose from downtown. Sunday morning in Grand Forks, a beautiful spring Sunday. On Saturday morning, I drove with thousands to the security of Grand Forks Air Force Base, 15 miles west of the city. I went to interview refugees. Some of them jumped up from the rumpled cots, bleary and unwashed, but smiling, greeted me by name. "Welcome back," they said. Never has this job been so hard. Sunday morning, and the birds sing. On the stoop of my brother's house, it seems like any Sunday morning. Church? There are no churches, not in town. There are no theaters open, no libraries, no bowling alleys, no Whitey's Wonder Bar across the river in East Grand Forks. Not now, not for a long time. I'm a reporter. That's why I'm here. And this is my report. Most of Grand Forks is flooded. Downtown is burning. My son, my brothers have gone, everybody. Has gone. That was a pretty poignant story on what to follow up on Heather's stories about how heroically people tried to defend their property and help others in the sandbagging process, and then to no avail, where the flood came in. The Grand Forks Herald was, he didn't know at that point, but they moved, the building burned, and it was a total loss, practically. So they couldn't continue to print it there. But they moved headquarters to a small town about 15 miles west of Grand Forks. And the crew gathered and did the news And then they brought it down to St. Paul, which has their sister paper, the Pioneer Press, did the printing of the Grand Forks Herald. And then it was brought back to Northwestern North Dakota and distributed to all the small towns and even in the Twin Cities. Wherever there were evacuees, the Grand Forks Herald was distributed. And it became a real lifeline for people. It became the one tangible thing that tied the community together that was now so scattered everywhere. And in fact, they would have a message board in the paper, the helpline, which would be messages that individuals would give in trying to find where people were. And you know, Mary Smith would say, "Where are you, Joe? You know, I don't know where you've gone. I can be reached at such and such a number." And this way, the paper would supply a communication between evacuees that were scattered all over, where many people didn't know where family members or friends were. And it was really a wonderful service. And they would continue to give reports of what was going on in terms of Grand Forks itself, and reports on other communities and what kind of help was coming in. They highlighted Clinton's visit when he came on the 22nd. But I think the important piece there was that in spite of the losses that they suffered, they continued on and became such a important lifeline between people of the evacuees. The mayor of Grand Forks too was, she was a pretty remarkable woman, wasn't she? She also lost, I think her home was flooded.
Actually, her home made it through.
Did it make it through?
She felt really bad.
Okay.
She did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then it was the mayor of East Grand Forks. But she would give words of encouragement to the Grand Forks people before they were leaving, and said, "We will rebuild and we will have faith, and I believe in our people. And I believe together we'll all pull out of this and our city will be stronger. Walk away from those homes, walk away from those buildings. We can rebuild it." And I think one of the amazing feats of the flood was that there weren't many lives lost. There were about five casualties, I think, attributed to the flood. But I know there was an elderly couple that got washed away by floodwaters that they finally found the van.
That was in Devil's Lake?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In Grafton, actually. Yeah. In Grafton. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing that there wasn't more loss of life in a disaster of that size. Now, my part of the story, I worked with the American Red Cross as a national mental health disaster team, and out of the St. Paul chapter. And I arrived in Fargo on the 30th of April, sometime after, well, about a week, I suppose, after Clinton's visit. And Fargo was the headquarters for the Red Cross in a empty Walmart building. They had set up shop, and it was just an amazing, huge space with all these different functions going on all over, like a busy as an anthill. And the Red Cross is a huge organization and has many, many different functions going. It felt kind of chaotic when I was there, and I thought, how can things get done in out of something like this, but they do. There were volunteers coming in from all across the country, coming in and leaving at different times, and all of this had to be coordinated. So we would go through you know, the usual paperwork and having signatures signed, and then get our assignments from our different functions. Mine would be the mental health, so I went to that function. And there were three of us, three mental health workers, one from Manhattan, New York, and one from Michigan, and I, that got our car assignment, and we drove off at 6 o'clock at night from Fargo, 5.5 hours away, for our motel room, because motels were very hard to come by because there were so many different groups, Red Cross and FEMA people, National Guard, Coast Guard, and evacuees that were all sort of vying for any motel rooms. So we got there about midnight and then had to get up and drive 75 miles back to Grafton, which is a little town over here, which we were going to set up a Red Cross service center. And the Red Cross would go out into some communities and set up a service center in order to service evacuees that were in the area. There were about 3,000 evacuees up in that area. So there were about 25 Red Cross people. They would have a damage assessment, and there would be family service people that would get a narrative story from the evacuees on what their needs were and hand out vouchers, because the Red Cross deals with emergency needs, immediate needs for people. So many, many evacuees came into the center. And my role as a mental health worker was basically schmoozing. The mental health people are responsible for the sort of mental health of the volunteers, Red Cross volunteers. So we kind of keep an eye out for stress levels with volunteers, because when you're working with victims of disasters, you can take on, you know, secondary kind of, it's very stressful too after many days and weeks of this. So we would keep an eye out and talk with volunteers, as well as do some diffusing of problems that would arise and debrief people as they left the service center. Then we would also work with the evacuees who came in. And as they would be waiting for different functions to take care of their needs. So we talk with them and also listen, basically listening to their stories, because it's important for them to talk about their stories and to be able to express some emotion. One woman who had just been back to see her house for the first time in Grand Forks and was telling me about it rather stoically, and then suddenly just broke down because it had been so stressful to see the damage and the loss and what it was going to entail for rebuilding. And so giving people permission to express their feelings and their emotions, which there was a whole gamut of them. Many brought families in, children. Children, many of them had left without any of their toys, or especially from the places where they didn't expect to be affected by the floods. We had toys and stuffed animals that they could go and pick out. It was always such a joy to see the kids finding a special stuffed animal that clutch it to them and kind of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face. We also put up newsprint on the walls and would have color crayons and work with the children in drawing pictures of what the flood experience had been for them. One 3 1/2 year old little girl, I was working with her, and she had talked about having to leave their house, and so I asked if she wanted to draw a house, and she said, "No, you draw the house." And so I drew the house with a outdoor and some windows, and I said, "Okay, now you draw the water." She said, "Well, it isn't going to be blue, it's going to be orange." Mm-hmm. And then she picked up an orange color crayon and started zigzagging, and she said, "The water crawled through the door and went down the basement." It was just a marvelous picture, child's picture of what, how the water happened in her awareness of it. There were many, many stories that I heard in that center. One woman who came in with a child and said that she had not expected to that their home would be affected by it, because they lived in an area where the dikes were strong. And it was on Saturday. No, it was on Friday, when she heard the siren and she looked out the window, and the storm sewers were bubbling up, and suddenly the manhole, she said, erupted like geysers. It was just swooshing like geysers into the air, and they knew that they had to get out quickly because the street was going to fill up very fast. So they just grabbed coats, just whatever, within a few minutes. They also had a family living with them that they had given refuge to from East Grand Forks, whose house had been inundated. So there were two families there, and they all then just had to get out very quickly. Some streets were already too filled with water, so they had to find their way out. And she said, "We went up the exit ramp to the freeway in order to make their getaway out of town." So it happened so fast for some people. They were just really caught off guard. And they had not done nothing in terms of bringing things out of the basement or putting things away. So she had no idea what she was going to find when she went back. There was a farmer. Many of these farm communities along here are little towns along the river. Like I said, there was just a sea of water. We went down to that area and looked at it. There was a farmer that came in, a 62-year-old man, Sven, from Oslo. You can just about figure out what. There were communities where it was Warsaw, which was a Polish community. Oslo must have been a Norwegian community. There was an Icelandic community. There were interesting ethnic communities around there. But this man, it all, as he was talking about his story, and he said, "Well, the outbuildings are probably pretty well gone, but the house is about half filled with water, so maybe I can save that." And then he paused and he said, "But this isn't the first time. I was born to this," he said. This was his family farm. He was born there, and they've always had to deal with the floods. But this one was particularly, in 79, it was very bad. And then he paused again and he said, "But I'm getting a little tired of it." can't read by this time, 62 years. And he said, people ask me, why do you stay there? And I say to them, why do you stay where you live? It's home. And he had bought out his brothers, and so there was no way. He said, nobody wants to buy this because of the flood problems. I also had a story about a friend of mine, actually, who lived in Grand Forks, and her husband was a hospital administrator. And he had retired, the husband had retired, she had run a gift shop. The husband also had the beginnings of Parkinson's disease, so they were going to take a trip before the disease manifested more symptoms. They decided they would take a trip. Well, their daughter was pregnant, living someplace else, and discovered she was going to have triplets. She had them early. And the son-in-law had lost his job, so they had no income. So they came home to live with the parents. This was the first part of March. So they were living there as all of this began to happen. They hadn't thought that they would have a problem either. But when the electricity went out, it got very cold. And how do you keep a big old house warm for three premature 7-week-old babies? They hung blankets and all in archways to try to keep a room warm. And then they finally went over to a nursing home close by that had a generator, and so they slept in the lounge area of the nursing home. When they did get back to their house, the electricity had gone back on. That night they were awakened. About 6 o'clock in the morning, they were awakened and told that they would have to evacuate because the dikes had broken. So they were sent to a hotel downtown. And at midnight that night, they again were told that they had to leave. So you can imagine, it's hard to imagine three premature 7-week-old babies and all the paraphernalia to Moorhead to another son and stayed there, and then went on to open up a cabin in Otter Tail area, where they were going to all congregate and have a place to stay until the flood waters went down. But there's so many different stories about people's experience. Oh, one of the things with that, when they left the house, they had three cars there, so they took two and they drove one downtown and parked it in the top floor of a parking ramp. And when they were in Moorhead and were watching on television the pictures of the fire, and it was scanning the downtown area, they saw the parking ramp and saw their car still parked. The fire had not reached the parking ramp. They saw their car, they knew where it was parked on that top floor of the ramp. The ironies. There were also, I didn't work with them, but one of my colleagues had, where she was at a shelter where there were Bosnian refugees who had lost everything in Bosnia and come to Moorhead to start a new life. And with the flood, they had lost everything again. So the compounding of losses for some people was another tragic part of the story. Well, many other stories, but I won't get into to more of them. The stories of compassion. We did some outreach in communities north of there, Langdon, Valhalla. We took a small group of Red Cross people and set up in American Legion halls and talked with people that would come in. Communities, churches and communities, civic groups, they would alternate cooking meals and serving them every night so that the families, host families, could have respite. There were supplies of all kinds. The churches would open up and people would donate clothing, because many people didn't have more than the clothing on their backs, would be donated for use, and so churches would set up areas for people to come and pick up supplies and that. Social service agencies would be dealing with various needs. You know, when people left, many were on, like with chronic ailments, and they didn't have their medications, so they would need to get a resupply of medications. The Red Cross nursing area could help with that, and pharmacies around were willing to fill them. So it's hard to imagine, you know, the extent of the needs and of people when you leave. It is sort of like a war zone where you are refugees in a very real way. And you don't know if you go back what you're going to be facing. Many different people in communities. There was a pastor in a town near Grafton where there was a Bible camp, and he mobilized pastors in the community and other people in the community, and they had 50 people living there, evacuees, who would help with cooking and keeping up some of the housekeeping and all. And also it was a place then where many different groups could bring supplies and things that would be available for evacuees. He had pastors in the area coming out on a, signing up for a day to come out and spend talking and listening to people and helping them in that way. So there was so much of this within smaller communities that took people in so many different ways and supported them in their needs. And then of course there were the government agencies. FEMA was there, and many, many different FEMA people that would go around. They went back to Grand Forks and checked with people as they went back to their homes to see the damage, because they're the ones that would be handling the longer term needs. Red Cross was there. Salvation Army set up big depots of all sorts of supplies. Truckloads of supplies would be coming in every day from different communities, from different corporations, from you name it. It was just many, many, many supplies that were available to people of all kinds, and cleaning supplies, because they had to go back and start the cleaning process. So the stories, what it, in thinking back on it, let me say one more thing. When I left to go to Fargo, we drove through Grand Forks on our way back to Fargo, and it was raining that day, which made it even more dismal in a way to see this flooded area in the rain. And like you saw on in some of the papers or on television, the curbs were just lined, stacked with the possessions of people. And it was so disheartening to see that. I just wanted to cry myself, because it meant such disruption of people's lives. Jobs had been lost. Some houses would not be able to be reclaimed. In fact, some areas were going to be razed because of floodplains. So whole communities would be lost, neighborhoods, friends. And some places were still underwater. Some houses were still underwater at that point. It was really a very disheartening kind of sight to wander through, and we walk through some of the streets. You had to be careful how you walk, because the muck on the streets was so slippery, and clay, soil. The contamination of the homes. We saw the water level on many homes where it was up to the middle of the first floor windows. So you knew that many of these homes probably would not be able to be reclaimed. So just a lot of sadness for these people. It's going to be a long, long time in reclaiming and rebuilding. So they're going to need a lot of help, and they are getting help. But I think the emotional needs, and this goes back to the communities again, where as they set up, the hospitals reopened, other businesses reopened, where people could begin to be back in their communities again and check in with people that they knew, their doctors and other services. They were setting up, FEMA set up small mobile homes that they could live in their backyards, and there were porta potties all around the communities. So they could live in the mobile homes and work on their houses. When I was there, there were people that were already in their houses carrying out the trash that was going to be discarded. There were the angel that you talked about. They gave $15 million for $2,000 for all of those within a certain flooded area. There were many angels. There were many angels that many that we heard about, many that we won't hear about, that reached out to people. And I was thinking with the Holden theme for this summer, No Longer Strangers. A disaster like this really breaks down the walls between people and the barriers, and there's the human response to other human beings. It was so noticeable in so many different ways. And that was the kind of saving grace of this flood. So the flood of compassion was also a flood where so much compassion was outpouring and will continue to be needed in so many different ways. And it was a way of establishing communities within communities, and maybe communities on a more larger level, national, state and national level too, where people, strangers, got involved in some way with responding to the needs of these people. Any questions or comments, stories?
2 years ago, Oregon also had major flooding. We lost our avenue to Portland from Highway 30 for approximately 3.5 months. Mm-hmm. And town of Vernonia lost all avenues of even getting in and out for approximately 2 months. Other than the major landholder, logging landholder owned a private road. And in the morning, outgoing people could go out. In the afternoon, incoming supplies could come in. And pretty much devastated two communities and another very small community, literally wiped out the whole river valley.
That never rebuilt again?
People who were not close to the river, maybe the 500 feet from the river, lost everything. You have anywhere from a foot to 6 feet of mud. Still, all the trees are still pretty much wiped out, but people above on the hillside, in the Oregon's hills and valleys, but the outpouring of people were being able to see that and knowing that was being provided there really brought that home to me, knowing that it happened on a smaller scale. We're used to that. We live on the coast and you're used to having flooding, and but the inland Portland almost having their floodwaters above. And then yearly having areas where there's always flooding people. Like the, remember
like
the gentleman,
yes.
His house was flooded every year. You always knew Johnson Creek always flooded. And why do people live there? You know, that's the way they live. That's the way it is.
You were saying at the beginning of your talk that when you hear stories like this, Bill, you you can't help but think about yourself, you know, and I think that's one of the values of hearing other people's stories. One of the things that you can't help but think about is what's so hard for people is that we are defined to a big extent by our possessions and by the accoutrements that we have. And our occupations, the things that we hold dear to us, our pictures, and you name it. And whether we like it or not, those are the things that do help define us, our geography.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
And you take that away from people, and you know, that strikes you. You really realize that is important, whether you like it or not. Material things do help define us, and even though we shouldn't dwell on material things, you're stuck because that is part of what makes you different than the other refugee. And the other thing is that you can't help but when you saw that happen, especially the fires that night, that were so astounding to see that was to realize how in the days of the internet and our dependence on computers and stuff, how fragile and vulnerable we still are. And how when that happened, if you take away electricity, sewer and water and shelter, and especially for the people that didn't have families. They're no better off than the people in Rwanda. And there's a basic, you take away that stuff, and everybody's really on equal footing in this world. And that's what's scary about it. I think that's what affects all of us. I think that's why there was such an outpouring from strangers.
Because you can identify. It could happen to any one of us. Right. Yeah. That sense of vulnerability that is there.
Have you been back since you left that time? Mm-hmm.
Tell us about when you went back.
Oh, that was very hard. I live in a lot of apartments. I live in an apartment building, and there's tons of apartments there, and always the streets are packed with cars, and I drove into town, you know, had to check with the National Guardsmen as I came in, and it was empty. There was no one there. And it was frightening, actually. And then I drove through some of the neighborhoods, and I don't know how I didn't cry, because that lady who I mentioned was washing her van. As I was driving to go help Sam bake, all her couch and her coffee tables and lamps and her carpet were now on her lawn. And just imagine your communities, and you could hardly see the houses for the piles of their belongings. And it was so hard for me because even though I wasn't affected, it was my community, and I did try to help prevent that, and it was just the biggest sense of loss that I've ever felt. It's hard. Even when I think about it, it gets me. A lot of people, when we went to the Air Force Base to pick up our mail, they had a mail station there. And the theme here, no longer strangers, you know how you live in a block, and you know, you see your neighbors, you get in and out of your cars, you have your fences between your yards, You might say hi here and there, maybe a summer block party, but at this Air Force Base, people are running to embrace each other, neighbors, and how did you fare? Water in my basement. Oh, good. You know, people excited if they had water in their basement and not on the main level. And it was just really hard to see. There was some humor in it all. People had all their belongings on their front lawn, and there was no bathrooms yet. There was a porcelain toilet on someone's front lawn, and people would spray paint on their junk, little messages, and a porcelain toilet with a sign behind it that said flood relief, which was funny. There were messages all over, and the one that stuck with me was, praise God anyway. And that just, you know, the whole town, I can't explain it, but just the garbage and the smell of the sewer water and just the utter destruction of the water lines on the houses. And I saw houses that had flooded off their bases onto the car in the driveway, decks on top of the dikes, trash cans on top of the trees, a garage that had flooded five blocks. And it was just utter devastation. But people were there, and people were trying to rebuild and give them their life.
And I think, in a sense, some of the people I talked to still seem to be kind of in a state of shock. There was a kind of heroic sense of, we can go back, we can rebuild. And then after going back and seeing some of the damage, the reality began to set in. But there is a resilience there. There is a resilience, and hopefully many will. It's almost therapeutic to begin to go back and feel like they can begin the process of rebuilding, if they can reclaim their homes. You know. There's something good about beginning that process and getting help. There was so much appreciation. Over and over again, many evacuees were just astounded by the outpouring. And I heard from several, we weren't forgotten. And it was a sense of the people remembered us. They did not forget us, which was important. Yes, Anne.
I think you just keep hearing the little things that are symbolic of how much has to be done. Mm-hmm. That one of the women in our church, our former youth director, has been decided to leave after 6 years and has been without a job for a year because she's really been looking for what she should do. And she is now going to be setting up all the daycare for kids. Because here we have a summer with the kids that have stayed there. And
exactly.
I mean, there's no place for them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing
mm-hmm.
for them to do. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a big inpouring of college age. They're bringing in only people who have had at least 1 year of college, and she will be training them and setting up programs in that area. Through Lutheran LSS in that area is one of the key agencies, and the FEMA is indicated, and she works for Lutheran. There's a Lutheran
social service?
No, it's Lutheran Disaster Relief.
Oh,
it's called.
Okay.
And she said there's only like 4 or 5 employees, but then they go into the region and mm-hmm. they hire, and she's being hired by them to run the daycare.
Well, all the daycare.
Well, day camps is what they're going to do. They're going to do day camps for kids.
All the different systems, you know, were disrupted with the schools. Many of the schools in the outlying areas absorbed children and young people from the Grand Forks area, so that became an issue too. Then hiring teachers from Grand Forks to come to teach in some of these other schools because of the expanded classrooms. We actually spent some time meeting with some of the students too, which was.